Was your case really the first neuropsychiatric case ever in DBS?
I have to say, I think so, and to the best of my knowledge. But what reassures me is that Marwan Haris, the eminence Greece in our field, has thoroughly investigated that. He's a walking encyclopedia, and he said, actually, this is the first case. So when I planned the first case, and I looked at the hotspot where Lozano described the hotspot, my goodness, it's exactly where Bartonu tablets.
Interesting.
So I think that it's more about stimulation of the butt nucleus of the stria terminalis as fornix stimulation. You know that the lead is implanted just anterior to the fornix, so you rather stimulate the butt nucleus than the fornix itself.
Welcome to Stimulating Brains.
It was my great pleasure to speak with Professor Veerle Visser van der Walle, who is the head of the Department of Stereotactic and Functional Neurosurgery at University Hospital of Cologne. At age 34, Veerle published the first neuropsychiatric DBS case in the modern era, a patient with Gilles de la Tourette syndrome who also suffered from self-injurious behavior. Now, Veerle leads the department of one of the key centers in Germany at University of Cologne, where she has operated on patients with many indications such as Parkinson's disease, dystonia, tremor, OCD, Alzheimer's disease, and pain. We talk about her earlier and present work, segmented electrodes, the crisis of access to DBS in OCD, her being a knight of Leopold II, and about a book that she published in 2020. Thank you so much for tuning in and enjoy Stimulating Brains.
Okay, so thank you so much, Veerle, for taking part in this. It's a great honor to talk to you about deep brain stimulation.
It's my honor. Thank you, Andy, for this invitation.
Thank you. And to break the ice, as you, I think you know, I often ask about hobbies, so or things you do beyond medicine and science. So what do you do when you're not in the OR or in the clinic?
Well, I try to take a little bit care of my body. So I used to do horse riding. I still have a horse, but that costs a lot of time. So what I do apart from that is running, jogging. And I started 2 weeks ago with yoga. I always thought that yoga was a little bit boring, but I found out that it's very good for the muscles and very relaxing. So I started with a new hobby, yoga.
Very cool. So then, you know, going into your career more broadly, who were key mentors that were important for you, or also turning points that were important to get where you are now?
Yeah. So a very important mentor for me was Jacques Camat. He was the head of the neurosurgery department at the University of Ghent in Belgium. And when I was a student, I started working and walking around there, spending time at the Department of Neurosurgery. And he told me about the Bull of Delgado at the time. So the Bull of Delgado is a story of 1960-65. And Delgado was a Spanish neurophysiologist who wanted to prove that you can change any unwanted behavior by means of deep brain stimulation. You know, the experimenter.
Yeah. We even have an episode on that.
Okay, great. And then I just knew, later I want to do deep brain stimulation. It was like a hit on my head. Then I knew. And then I went, at that time, he was not yet head of department. That was Luc Callao. And I went to Professor Callao and I said, could you please advise me? I want to do an internship somewhere to learn more about psychosurgery. And then he said, And I said, my girl, that doesn't exist. You could go to Alfred Hitchcock, he said at the time. But even he only has about 5 cases a year. It doesn't exist. So, okay. And then I focused on training on general neurosurgery. But I never left that idea. I always wanted to do the brain stimulation.
And yeah. And he said it doesn't exist in Belgium, you mean? Or what term is that?
He wanted to say that not one surgeon in the world has so many cases that you can say, okay, I go for a few months to London or wherever, or in the States and see many, many cases in the realm of psychosurgery. Yeah.
So from Ghent, next stop was, I think, Maastricht. Is that correct? Or
yeah, but perhaps. So I started my training in Bruges, and that was really focused on general neurosurgery. I did a lot of spine surgery there and tumor surgery. It was a very good training, but there was no time for DBS. And then my last year, I had to go back to Ghent. And then, so I finished my training in the beginning of 96. And then we started with DBS.
In Ghent.
Jacques at the time started in 96 with deep brain stimulation and Parkinson's disease then, of course, with the neurologist Chris van der Linden. And I was very lucky to be able to assist then as a trainee. And then after I finished my training, I stayed there at University Hospital in Ghent. And then in later in that same year, or the beginning of the 97, Chris van der Linden sent me then a patient with Tourette syndrome.
Okay.
And would you like to continue?
That will be one key topic, but it's exactly the next one. So I think at that time you were 34, right? Roughly, at least when you had the paper out. So probably you were a bit younger.
When the paper came out. When the paper came out.
and that was the paper in The Lancet after the world's first successful operation on one patient with Tourette syndrome. That was probably that patient you were just mentioning. So yeah. I'd love to hear a bit more about that, you know, how the idea emerged and, you know, what the process was, how it felt at the time.
So the movement disorder neurologist who was involved in the DBS program was Chris van der Linden. So at the time we did many Parkinson and trauma patients. And then at a certain moment in time, he sent me a patient with Tourette syndrome. And he asked, do you have any idea? Could you help him with the brain stimulation? And I found it, of course, very interesting. And the patient was really suffering and had a very low quality of life. He also had severe self-injurious behavior. But he had a young son, and that son also started to show tics. And that was a motivation for the patient to seek help and to go to the university hospital and to say, okay, do anything what you want with me, do any experiment on me. I would like to find you a solution for Tourette syndrome so that when my son gets older, that he can have the treatment. Mm-hmm. So then I dove into the literature, and of course, no DBS was at the time performed in Tourette syndrome. But then I found the paper of Hassler and Diekmann, where they described their results with thalamotomies. But the problem was that Hassler had made more than 10 coagulations each side, so the trick was to find one strategic point. And I defined that, at the anteromedial border of the centromedial nucleus and along the ventrolateral nucleus, or the VOI, because it plays an important role in facial tics. And, so I planned surgery in that case. And I remember when I went to the OR, Jacques Camart joined me, and then I went to the right side to the OR, and he had to turn to the left side. He had to see patients on the intensive care unit. He was not involved in the surgery. And at that time, I had to work on a PhD. And I said, okay, if this succeeds, then you have proven a lot more to me than writing a PhD. And well, luckily, the result was good. And then we published that case. It was in 1990. It was not a big article. It was only one site. Yeah? But of course, the significance was that, or the importance I know now, is that it was the first case with a psychiatric disorder, because at that time we did the surgery mainly with the goal, or with as a primary endpoint, to reduce the tics, and so we could easily get the permission, so to say, to do a surgery on this case. But that opened the door, I think, to other psychiatric indications to be treated with DBS, because soon thereafter, Bach-Notin published his cases with OCD, his OCD cases treated with simulation of the entire capsule. Soon thereafter, in October 99, so my case was published in February, and his cases with OCD in October of the same year. So another Belgium, so two Belgians. So-
That is such a cool story, and I have to really further emphasize it, because also I think there was a third first in that year, and all three were published in The Lancet. I think Joachim Krauss always mentions that in his talks, because the third one was the dystonia cases that he published. So that was a huge year for DBS. And as you said, two Belgian, and also, like, was your case really the first neuropsychiatric case ever in DBS? Like, I mean, in the modern area, let's say before, after after Heath and so on. But in the modern DBS area, that was the first case. Is that?
I have to say, I think so, and to the best of my knowledge. But what reassures me is that Marwan Haris, the eminence of Greece in our field, has thoroughly investigated that. He's a walking encyclopedia, and he said, actually, this is the first case.
Great. That's a cool, yeah. And I mean, were the, like, talking again about these three Lancet papers, all in 1999, Joachim Krauss, your case, yours was first, then Bach-Notin. I don't know when Krauss came out in that same year, but they were all in the same year, so were they connected at all? Was there a lot of exchange, or was it just the time was ripe to try new things with DBS? What do you think?
Not at all. They were not connected at all. And for sure, the one of Krauss, not, because it was in the realm of movement disorders.
Sure.
And the fact that Bach-Notin published it in the same year was actually, I would say, a coincidence. I think, like you said, the time was ripe for that.
Yeah. I mean, this was how many years after the, like, maybe 8 years after the first STN or VIM cases, right? Roughly, or 10 years.
Yeah,
maybe,
roughly.
Because probably you all heard about these before the papers came out and conferences and so on. So this was probably enough time to, try something new now. And
yes, absolutely.
As a follow-up, your team as well had a double-blind clinical trial published in Brain 2004. I think that was another landmark paper, first authored by Linda Ackermans. What did you find there? Can you broadly summarize that?
Well, when I think of that study, I get a little bit of stomach pain. It was so difficult to recruit patients. Mm-hmm. So we had a study group with experts from the Netherlands and from Belgium. And so we have really had the experts, but it was so difficult to recruit patients. Mm-hmm. And then, so we had, in total, we had 8, but then we had 2 dropouts. Okay. One patient, so it was double-blind study with a 3-month crossover phase, that was the plan. And then one patient was sure that he was in the off phase, and he went to another neurologist who was not involved in the study, and he had the stimulation switched on. So there were 2 similar dropouts. So we only had 6 patients.
Okay.
And the result was good. So after 3 months, there was an effect of about 43% tick reduction. That was far less than we had in the initial pilot study. But that, of course, was due to the fact that the patients were evaluated in a double-blind phase manner. Mm-hmm. And then after 1 year, the result was better. Then we had a reduction of about 50%.
Great. So the first case, it was a 42-year-old man. So that was the 1999 Lancet patient who had apparently 38 ticks per minute before surgery. And then after surgery, you really said the ticks disappeared completely. And you also write that the patient's character had become more kind-hearted.
Absolutely. Yeah, I remember that very well. So he used to call me Wähler. That was a little bit what we say in German, distanzlos. So normally Belgian people say, hello, doctor, but he said, Wähler. At a certain moment in time, he came in the clinic, he entered my room and said, God damn it, Wähler, ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-tam. And then I knew that the stimulation was out. I was almost sure, and it was out. There was a clear difference. There was a clear difference between the two. He was a lot more aggressive, I mean, and verbally aggressive when the stimulation was switched off. I think it was off due to the end of life of his battery or so. We didn't know that it was switched off. And then when it was on, he was a lot kinder and softer. I've also seen that in other patients, yeah. Yeah.
Did he mention that himself as well, or did he notice himself? Do you remember?
Yeah, he knew that.
And he was happy about it, I could imagine.
Yes. The second patient had something similar, but he said that, so when the stimulation was switched on, he was calmer, and when it was off, he had a lot more energy, and he used to run in the woods. And then he switched his stimulation off because then he had a lot more energy.
Oh, exciting.
And then more ticks, but he didn't care because he was alone in the woods.
Huh.
There is a difference. It makes them more calm, more introvert. One patient said to me that if he's on the street and he meets strangers, or for example, he wants to draw money out of the wall, and he's there are other people waiting, that before surgery, he used to start talking with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And after surgery, with stimulation, he was a lot more reserved and didn't talk so easily with strangers. So there is a difference. There is a change in personality in many patients, yes. Which is not abnormal for us if they're calmer. But for them, it's a difference that counts, huh?
Sure. And you could imagine, like with the one that's running in the roots, that you sometimes want both, right? It really is dependent of karma is probably usually better, but not always, right? It is interesting. Yeah.
Absolutely. And that underlines again the need for a reversible treatment so that the patient can change it and go back to the initial condition when he wants.
That's a great point. I guess we're referring to DBS versus lesioning, right? So, So, based on you based your decision back on based on the Hassel and Diekmann paper and their reports, and I think by doing that, you targeted the intersection between three thalamic nuclei at the time, at least. I think now you slightly reversed it. So the central median, the VOI, and then the substantia periventricularis. And I just interviewed Marie Kruger. I don't know if you know her. Together with Chris Honey had a similar target in the thalamus, also intersecting three nuclei. And what they did is, I think, was DBS for dental pain. And they then used, found it quite interesting, they used segmented electrodes to try to find out which of these three nuclei would make most sense. And of course, when you did it back in the day, there was no segmented lead. But did you ever think about doing that with Tourette and trying to, you know, titrate a bit better? Which of these three nuclei is the one or the key one? Or do you think it is really the intersection that we need? Or what's your opinion on, you know, which nucleus really matters? Or is it the combination of the three?
Well, at that time, I thought, the CM and the SPV, or I thought that with those three nuclei, we would be able to influence different circuits, the motor circuits as well as the limbic circuits. Then when I discussed this with Jérôme Jelinek in Paris, an anatomist, he said, the SPV, it doesn't exist. It's nothing. So, okay, I left SPV out in the name of the nucleus, but it doesn't exist. Okay. So in the VOI has afferents towards the cortex, and the CM projects it back towards the striatum. And I thought that it was, at that time, smart to simulate those simultaneously. And now it depends on the individual case. So sometimes we stimulate only the VOI after surgery. I always implant the electrode at the same spot, but sometimes the patient has the best result with the more dorsal contact. Sometimes with the deepest contact. My experience is that with the deepest contacts, they tend to have this reduced energy more.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then I know that it will have an effect on ticks. And if the reduced energy is felt to be unpleasant, then we change the frequency. When you lower the frequency, then it's often better. So then we can keep the effect on the ticks without this reduced energy. But I don't think we really, really need directional leads for an optimal result. But of course, we are interested in using them to know actually what is the most optimal target. But apart from the directional leads, we focus, of course, together with you on the tracts and tractography. Mm-hmm. And with the limited experience that we have, there is nobody in the world has a really large thread database.
Sure.
We have found that it looks like the tracks towards SMA and pre-SMA are the important ones. But at that time, we didn't have direction leads, we didn't have tracks.
Yeah. No. I mean, more like, could this be, and I totally agree, you probably don't need it clinically, but since we have them, you know, it could be a nice research tool to titrate absolutely. Or find out a bit more.
Yes, so, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So you mentioned the deeper contacts as well, and I have a guest question actually from a postdoc of mine, Clemens Neudorfer, who was actually in Cologne as a young neurosurgeon, I think before your time.
Yeah.
He's currently doing a postdoctoral with me in Boston, was with Lozano before, and he asks what you would think about the Forel field or fasciculus thalamicus as a target for Tourette's, with the idea that essentially going deeper, a bit like in VIM, you would go deeper to the, you know, where the fibers from the DRT come in. Could it make sense to go deeper into the like thalamic, ventral thalamic area where the fibers come in? Or do you think that is, in this case, a different, yeah, what's your experience with that or opinion on that?
I think then you target more motor fibers than limbic fibers.
I see, okay.
And it could make sense. You know that there is a large Tourette database. Michael Oakland took the initiative to start with a database, which is absolutely great.
Yeah.
And the results have shown that the results of all targets together are good. So the thalamic one, as the GPI one, the anterior GPI, as well as the posterior motor GPI. So I could imagine that simulation of the Forel field would also have an effect, but I continue with thalamic stimulation. Sometimes this question, I hear this question, okay, which is the best target? I would say one important issue is that if you are really well experienced with one specific target and the result is good, why would you change then?
That's a good point.
A role with which target are you most experienced
as a whole center, probably, even right? Only the surgeon, but also probably the people that program it.
Absolutely.
So I think Joachim Kraus had one series of patients with four electrodes in both targets, GPI and thalamus. Could that be an option to do, or would you say in most cases two electrodes is enough and you know you're satisfied with the results?
I have to say, in principle, I am against implanting four electrodes in a patient's brain or using two targets simultaneously. I'm not against implanting four leads in a brain, but I have my opinion is that you should focus on one target and see then what the results are. Yeah. And if they're not enough, then you can add more targets, more electrodes afterwards. But makes in sense. Principle, I'm against implanting four leads at a time and to see, okay, which is the best one. It sounds a little bit too experimental to my ears.
Makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. So the intralaminar nuclei of the thalamus that you target also with your target are the only ones that project to the striatum. And I think they also project diffusely to almost the entire neocortex. Do you have a pathophysiological understanding, or does that play a role? Is that why you think these nuclei are important, that they project to the striatum, or what's loose idea?
Yeah, that's the hypothesis a little bit, that it closes the gate a little bit, because so the idea is that in TERT patients, there's continuously an overstimulation, not only from the cortex, but also via the thalamus back towards the striatum. So the brake is not active enough, or the stimulation is too high. The feedback loop is leads to an too high stimulation of the striatum.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the idea.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's often
wrong, but
That is often the case. But that's good to know. So, okay, let's make a big jump. You have not only worked on TERT, you've worked on a lot of things. So 20 years later, I think currently a key research target, if I'm correct, is Alzheimer's disease that you're quite interested in. You are part of the Advanced Trial 2. And by doing so, target the fornix region. And I think you told me at some point that you think the bed nucleus of striatum terminalis, which is very close by, might be the actual key target.
Yes.
Any general thoughts about fornix, DBS, and Alzheimer's disease? What are your experiences or targets?
Yeah. So first of all, I see it as my duty, and I think it's actually a duty of the DBS community to maximally exploit the potential of deep brain stimulation for Alzheimer's disease, because Alzheimer's disease, is a huge problem for society. The prevalence is very high, and it will only increase. It will be doubled by 2030, it's estimated. So I was very, very enthusiastic about this the advanced trial. And we started just before the first corona lockdown. Andres Lozano promised to be there for the first cases, but he couldn't make it due to corona. So I had to do this on my own. And he has explained me beforehand by mail how he does this targeting. And then, based on the first results in the first trials, he said that the hotspot was at the level of the anterior commissure. And then when I did the first planning, I thought, my goodness, that is exactly where Bart Nutin places his electrodes. Because long time ago, I followed an ECMT course of Medtronic in Leuven. See how Bart Nutin makes his planning, or where he his target is for OCD. And that's exactly in this triangle between the anterior commissure and the fornix. So when I planned the first case and I looked at the hotspot where Lozano described the hotspot, my goodness, it's exactly where Bartnutin is.
Interesting.
So I think that it's more about stimulation of the bed nucleus of the striatum terminalis as a fornix stimulation. You know that the lead is implanted just anterior to the fornix. So you rather stimulate the bed nucleus than the fornix itself.
Interesting. But and how are your first, if you can talk about that, your first experiences with Alzheimer's, did you see effects or any conclusions so far already?
Yeah. So we've implanted 9 Alzheimer patients right now. And the surgery is not that difficult. One thing that we should pay attention to is the fact that the risk of lead deviation is a little bit more higher due to the fact that you go through the ventricle, okay, just lateral, just middle from the caudate nucleus. And that's all fine when you implant the lead.
I'd like to hope that you the app chat needs.
Sorry, that's my watch. So you implant the lead through a cannula, a long cannula that goes up until a target. But when you retract the cannula, the lead might deviate a little bit. And I had it once that it ended up in the third ventricle. That's a risk of this surgery. But apart from that, the surgery is not that difficult. And of course, I do not know if those 9 patients, well, 8, because the 9th will be randomized next week. I don't know if they're in the on or off phase, but 2 patients are doing so incredibly better after surgery that I would put my hands in fire. Yeah, that they're in the on phase. I hope so, of course. Yeah, so one patient was a woman of 70-something, and she hadn't cooked for several years because she didn't know how to handle all the instruments. And then soon after surgery, she started cooking again.
Wow, is that fascinating.
Yeah. So let's hope she's in the on arm.
And I mean, I guess that is sometimes, you know, I wonder sometimes, are randomized clinical trials or group level trials even the best way to look at deep brain stimulation for new targets? Because I sometimes wonder if you operated on 10 of these patients and only one had a great impact, might still be worth it. And it proves, I mean, if it's worth it or not, that's a big ethical discussion, but it would prove that there can be an effect, right? So you could also always base that conclusion that, okay, you know, what is different in that one patient where it worked, and then, you know, refine it. So, but the opposite happened, for example, in depression. I think there's a new trial coming, so good news, but in depression, you know, these 2 failed trials essentially shut it down for a while. And so we're always looking at group level effects. And of course, yeah, I wonder sometimes, you know, what is the, could there be a better way of doing this instead of, because variance in placement will matter, variance in patient selection will matter. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I have to say that I'm really surprised that so many patients so easily consent to participate in such double-blind trials. Mm. I have to say honestly to you, and I hope no Alzheimer patients hear this, I would never say, okay, I will be so patient that I will wait for 1 year if I'm in the...
it's a whole year. Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but actually after 6 months, an interim analysis will be performed, but it could be that. Mm. Yeah. So I'm very surprised that so many patients consent, not only what this trial is concerned, but also what other double-blinded trials is concerned.
Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So your center, before doing the Phoenix trials, I think you also did basalis of minor DBS for Alzheimer's disease. Is that correct? So, and you might be one of the only centers now that have done both, or maybe the only center. So, or doesn't really matter, but do you have any, like, do you already know which one is better? So did you, what were your experiences in the basalis of minor?
Yeah. So it was my predecessor, Volker Sturm, who did, simulation of nucleus basalis marinet in Alzheimer patients. In total, he did 8 patients. So first the trial was 6 patients. And he found that the age and the level of functioning before surgery were the 2 most important factors. He had bad results in the young cases. And then he added 2 other cases. He planned to take younger cases, but one case was 65. So, but anyway, the results were also good in those 2 cases.
Okay.
We wanted to continue with this surgery, but I found it important that we would first get more insight in the mechanism and the possibilities with animal experiments. So we're continuing now with animal research with nucleus basalis marinet stimulation. Apart from that, we know from the ADVANCE-1 trial that we can only expect a good effect of phoric stimulation in older patients. Mm-hmm. Because it was the younger patients, and this means younger than 65, were doing worse with stimulation in the first double-blinded trial. So now for this advanced 2 study, an important selection criterion is age. Mm. Only patients older than 65 are included. So then, of course, we need a solution for the patients younger than 65. And then I think of the nucleus basalis minute stimulation. And you know probably that Dave Blake in the US had found that the effect of nucleus basalis minute stimulation is better if you do not stimulate continuously, but intermittently. And we've done that in a transgenic rat model. And we found that indeed the results are better with intermittent stimulation than continuous stimulation.
Interesting. Okay.
So, yeah. So we will continue with that target, but then with the idea to treat younger Alzheimer patients.
Very interesting. That's so cool. So great. So I keep being, excited by the breadth of your work in Cologne, and we'll get into that as well at some point. But a month ago, to shift topics again, you first authored an international perspective article in Nature Medicine calling for action to make deep brain stimulation for obsessive compulsive disorder more available. You talked about a crisis of access together, I think, with Michael Okun and a lot of international colleagues. Can you summarize what the crisis is about or what the article was about?
Yeah. So my motivation to start writing this paper is that I'm so angry at the DBS, the manufacturers, because their influence is so huge. Mm-hmm. And if they decide, we're not interested in this or this indication because the prevalence is too low, even though the result might be good, no, the prevalence is too low, so for economic reasons, we're not that interested. I cannot accept that. So DBS for OCD had a CE mark, a conditional CE mark. And in the States, this was an humanitarian device exemption that meant that, okay, there was an DBS for OCD was reimbursed, but with the condition that long-term follow-up data would be collected. And then due to the new laws, the CE mark needs to be extended this year.
Okay.
But since the company is not that interested, they decided not to go for it, because of course it's a huge hassle to go for a CE lengthening. And that's the reason why the insurance companies don't reimburse DBS for OCD. I mean, what this initial target is concerned, the anterior capsule and the accumbens.
Yeah.
And of course, we're not the only ones with that bad experience. It's also, colleagues in the US and Australia and New Zealand have the same experience. That's why we united forces and we wrote this paper.
Interesting. I did not know that. So you're saying that essentially from this year on, OCD DBS is not approved anymore in Germany or in Europe?
Exactly.
Okay, and because it was not extended.
It wasn't extended, indeed.
Huh. Okay, that changes a lot, right? So taking back a step there. So that's great that I think there was a similar article in Australia, as you say, authored by Phil Mosley, also calling for. I think it's not even approved in Australia. It's more always study. I'm not sure, but the same idea was that it should be more approved care. Interesting. Do you have any? Did you get any feedback or from decision makers or from the companies?
No. And I'm really, really disappointed because I had many meetings with Medtronic beforehand to discuss this. What are the possibilities so that I can continue with the surgery? So I had expected that after publication of this paper, they would contact me and give their reaction or their reply or nothing. Mm. And that really makes me a little bit angry and disappointed that this influence of the companies.
Interesting. And I think back in the day when we collaborated on one project roughly, I realized you mentioned that you would love to also use the Boston Scientific long electrodes for ALIC, but that was also not possible because of similar reasons that it's only approved for Medtronic. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Interesting. So you're not...
A CE certificate is linked to a specific company and linked to a specific target, which is crazy. We discussed this in the International Work Group for Surgery for Psychiatric Diseases. It's really crazy. It's like if a surgical knife, would have a CE mark to be used only in the abdomen. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. We say, okay, is this knife safe or not? And then the surgeon decides, okay, with this knife, I'm going to do surgery in the thorax or in the abdomen or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, you could argue that, you know, I always find it interesting that the ablational surgeries were a bit more like that, where you say, you know, the device is CE marked, but not where exactly you would make the lesion. While in DBS, it's more about the specific target where you put it. And I think you could, in theory, argue both ways that, you know, if it's completely unrestricted, surgeons could, in theory, burn holes everywhere they want to, right? And of course, they need a good reasoning for it. But I don't know. It's an interesting topic. Why it is so different in ablational versus DBS surgery in general? Yeah.
And why is it linked to a specific company? That's also crazy.
Like you said,
the long octopolar leads of Boston would make more sense if you focus on the internal capsule. Then you could nicely investigate which tracts you need. But only linked to the Medtronic devices. And even then, only the 3391 electrode, which is absolutely crazy.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
It's a spinal electrode, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So similar question going in the same direction. Why is DBS for Tourette not approved yet?
Because the prevalence is far too low.
You're just lacking the numbers of getting a bigger trial running. Is that the...
Yeah.
Is it the monetary...
Yeah, absolutely. It's for economical reasons. The companies are not interested. This, in contrast to Alzheimer's dementia, it's very attractive for the manufacturers because the prevalence is so high.
And that's interesting. Yeah. I think there needs to be a solution for that, right? And that's exactly what your paper is about, where, you know, diseases should not be, you know, have a disadvantage because they're not so prevalent, right? Okay. Switching to a more positive topic, I think one key thing to note about your center in Cologne is how broad your functional surgery unit is placed. You are one of the few ones in Germany to operate on most, if not all, DBS indications. You know, you have psychiatric cases and, of course, all the movement disorder cases, Alzheimer's as well. And you also offer spinal cord stimulation, which is, I think, quite rare in Germany for pain. And even brachytherapy, I think, as one of the few centers in Germany. And my question is, for historical reasons, I think only Cologne and Freiburg in Germany are the ones that have a share of stereotaxy, right? In all other German cities, it would be a subdomain of neurosurgery, so there's no specific chair for that. So essentially, consultants are the functional neurosurgeons and doing their work under the hood of a professor then in neurosurgery. So do you think this plays a role for this unique service that you can offer, that you are, you know, full professor that has a kind of independent center from, I'm sure it's not completely independent from neurosurgery in general, but is that one reason, or is it more the historical reason that in Cologne, you know, there was always this big history, or is it just that you work harder than everybody else? How is that? Why are you able to offer so much?
Well, for sure, it has to do with the fact that we are an autonomous department. So completely autonomous. This means completely separate from the Department of General Neurosurgery. We also have our own OR theaters. We're responsible for...
I did not know that. That's completely
independent. But on the other hand, we have a very nice cooperation with the Department of General Neurosurgery.
Sure.
But it has huge advantages, and I also explain it sometimes to the patients. So in Maastricht, where I used to work for 13 years, that was not the case. It was only one department of neurosurgery. And then it happened that we planned a DBS on a Tuesday. And long beforehand, of course, because you have to do your tests for selection of cases and levodopa tests and so on and so on. And then on Monday, a child with a brain tumor came in. And then, of course, the child needs to be operated quickly. Mm. And the Parkinson patient who was trembling for 10 years could wait.
Mm. Yeah, sure.
We never have this in our department because we are independent. So, and that's the reason why we can do 2 to 3 DBS cases a week.
Great.
We also have a team of, I mean, we have a very close cooperation with the Department of Neurology. There's also a very dedicated team, which is of great advantage. It's an absolute, not only a plus, it's a conditio sine qua non. Without cooperation with the neurologist, you can forget about it. So we're also very lucky with that. And I'm stepping in the footsteps of my predecessor. He started the department, and I'm continuing it. And I feel privileged with the actual situation and also with the good teamwork with other departments.
Sounds great. Yeah. So I think, you know, that I totally agree with you. Because I've seen in other places in Germany, obviously, that the same thing as you've just described happens all the time. And there's also always this debate on surgery time, you know. So I could imagine that if it's more about just economic reasons, then probably the tumor cases are better and, you know, they're faster. You can do more of them in a day, and DBS blocks the OR for a longer time and so on. So there's always this, you know, discussion. And then, of course, the boss often is not a functional neurosurgeon. So their personal preference is, of course, different. So that's really cool. So speaking about rarer indications as well, and I think this again builds on older cases from Focus-Sturm, but you just published a study on connectivity from DBS sites in patients with self-injurious behavior. And that was a resident in your department was first author Petra Heiden, and she also presented in the DBS think tank. I found it super interesting, you know, that you also make good use of the old cases. You know, that should exactly be done, learning from these, I think. I also remember, and you mentioned it, that your first TS patient, Tourette's patient, also had self-injurious behavior. So do you think there might now become future for these indications more broadly with DBS?
Yeah. I think the patients with aggression that have been operated in my department before my time, they're the so-called forgotten cases, operated on with different targets and okay, which is the best targets. So I really appreciate that Petra Heiden and also Pablo Andrade, they focused on these patients and they looked for tractography, which tracts were relevant. We have done a case now almost 2 years ago, 1.5 years ago, with severe aggression. Petra Heiden also presented this case, I think, I'm not sure, due to birth injuries. She was very thin, so we couldn't do an DBS in her, because if there was not an effect immediately after surgery, she would hurt herself. So we did a lesion, we did a hypothalamotomy. And the effect the first year was so good that I think, okay, we have to continue with this. So we would like to draw the attention to this indication. It's also very important because the quality of life of those patients and also their family members is really devastating. So, I think it's a very important indication. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Great. So maybe one last question before we move to different topics is one other indication where I personally always think this is, you know, should be done more. It's, you know, so devastating quality of life, like, is pain. Do you do anything in that direction?
Also DBS. So I used to do it in Belgium also a long time ago. So I was in Belgium until 1999. And there we did about a little bit more than 12 cases with thalamic stimulation, VPM, VPL.
Okay.
And we had very good results in half of the patients. And then the other half we did not have a good effect. But those were all cases who were completely intractable.
Mm.
So it was worthwhile. Yeah, offering DBS. And then we switched to motor cortex stimulation. In Cologne, I did 3 cases, but the results are a little bit, in a way, disappointing because due to plasticity, often you have after a few years that the result is not good anymore. So I returned back to DBS. Pablo in our department, Pablo is now focusing on this indication too. And we did 3 cases and the results in those 3 are good.
And that's VPL.
I prefer DBS above motor cortex stimulation for pain.
What was the target again? VPL and VL?
VPM. So VPM. Nucleus ventral.
Posterior medial.
Ventral medial and ventral lateral. So okay. VPM for the face and arm, and then VPL for the leg.
Great. Okay. Very interesting. Is that already published or are you're still working on these?
We're collecting more patients and then we will publish it too.
Very, very cool. Okay, so shifting topics and gears. In 2020, you wrote a book in Dutch entitled in English, Plato and Cola or The Secret of Your Brain. And the description, I could not read it, it's in Dutch, but the description in English would read that it is a witty book about how our brains work, about the limitations of our thinking, and especially how to get out of it. And then about the evolution of our brains, which are compared to a bottle of Coke, but also about colors, God, Greek philosophers, creativity, and positive thinking. Can you summarize that? So how did you come up with the book, and what is it about?
It's very funny that you found an English description. I didn't know that.
I translated it.
Okay. So the idea is that you can have a happier life
mm-hmm.
and reach your goals if you know how to use your brain. It's all a matter of getting the right idea and getting the right inspiration. And I don't think I should tell people how to use their brain, but I can tell my son how he can use his brain because I put him on this planet, and then I know a little bit more than the brain about the brain than the average person. So I thought, mm-hmm. okay, it's important that I show him how his brain works. That's why I wrote the book. It was for his 18th birthday, and indeed, it's about, the title is Plato and Cola.
Okay.
Plato, because what you see, the reality that you see, is not there as the way you see it. It's actually kind of an illusion made by your brain. That's one. That's what Plato also described. The reality as you see it is not the real reality. It's a reflection of something else. That's one. And then Cola, based on how our professor of anatomy at the time used to explain brain evolution over the hundreds and millions of years. And he explained this by referring to a bottle of Coca-Cola,
mm-hmm.
so with which you shake,
yeah.
and then you open it, and then foam comes out. First, you have a little bit of foam, and then other foam comes on top of this, and then more foam on top of these 2 layers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he explained the three-in brain described by McLean. So first you have the reptilian brain. A reptile does not have any choice. If he's hungry and he sees food, he goes after it. It's yes or no. And then you have the paleomammalian brain, for example, an elephant. If he's hungry, but his friend just died and it's his food, he can decide not to take the food. So he has more choices. And then you have the neomammalian brain. Then I give the example of a businessman. His wife died, but he or a friend died. And then he decides not to be too sad, but focus on his work. So he has even more choices. So the idea is that during evolution, we always have more and more and more choices. Mm-hmm. To say no to our primary instincts, for example. Mm-hmm. And then another aspect of the book or another theme is the default network, which I am crazy about the default network because that's the network which gives us inspiration. And then I explain to my son how important it is to relax and let your thoughts go. And then you will find the right solution or the best idea to your problem. And then, of course, you might think, oh, so we should do nothing anymore and just relax. No, of course not. We should focus on a problem. You have a problem and you need a solution. So focus on the problem and then let it go. Do something else. Go for a walk or take a nap or something. And then often you found the best
idea. The default network kicks in and yeah, solves it for
yeah
you.
Thanks to our default network. Yeah.
And so I also heard that. So your son Casper's 18th birthday, that was the present. Did you say that? Like, did he read it? Did he like it?
No.
Okay.
After I had many interviews by journalists and say, oh, what did Casper think of it? I said, well, he didn't read it. He said that when he started reading the book, actually, mm-hmm, it are kind of letters to him. And I said, I hear you speaking to me, but it's so weird that everybody can listen to us then. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit emotional for him.
Makes sense. Do you have more children? Will there be second books, or is that the...
Well, I only have one child, but I was not finished writing yet, but the editor wanted to publish it. Mm-hmm. So it was then published, and then I continue writing. And then I wrote a second book. It's about the self-conscious brain. But I think it's funny that we can think of our own brains. And then those are letters to my niece.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Also in Dutch, though, or?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. How's the writing for you? How do you find the time? How do you structure that process?
Well, I wrote both in the COVID time.
I see. Okay.
Then for a longer period, we couldn't do any surgery. We couldn't go to congresses. So in the weekend, I wrote those books.
Well, sounds great. Okay. I think you were also quoted in the advertisement that, again, I translated, but you said something like, we can perform a mini DBS on ourselves every day, because you really can change the framework in which you think if you so choose.
Yeah.
Knowing where to find the inspiration for a personal model of thinking is what it comes down to. So how can we do the mini DBS? Is that what you just said with the relaxing or with the going for a walk, or are there other things you talk about?
That's one thing. And the other thing is pay attention to what you focus upon, or it sounds a little bit how would I say religious or whatever, but there's a saying, count your blessings, and it's so absolutely true. What you focus upon becomes bigger in your experience.
Mm-hmm.
If you always focus on bad luck and so on, you will have more bad luck, and if you focus on positive things and what you can do, you will have more opportunities.
Sounds great. Count your blessings. I'll take that on.
Yeah.
So I wanted to briefly mention, in 2019, you became a Knight of the Order of Leopold II for your exceptional achievements in your field. That's so great. Could you tell us a bit more about who Leopold II was and what this means?
Yeah, it was a consequence of the fact that I was on television.
Okay.
There is a program on television which is very popular. It's called Top Doctors. Mm-hmm. And there they follow a doctor in his field during a few months. And then they show the human part of the doctor, so to say.
Okay.
So people can have a look into the doctor's private life. And they followed me in Cologne. That was in a while ago. And since then, I'm more well-known in Belgium, I have to say. Mm-hmm. And, the result is also that I got this title. Because I think, I don't know how many people each year get this title, but then the king decided that I would be a good candidate.
Sounds great. Love it. So to wrap up, thank you so much. I have to be mindful of all your time, but I have some just more general questions before we conclude. Any eureka moments that you had in your career where you thought, oh, now I understood it, or this was great, or something like that?
Well, I have to say, after the first threat case, when there was good effect, I really had kind of a very happy aha moment. Aha, okay, we can continue with that. Then I have to think of that.
Or just like happy, successful moments. It doesn't need to be eureka, but just things that you, if you look back at your career, I'm sure the Tourette case is certainly one, but were there similar experience where you thought, oh, this was really great, or this was a great paper or a great, case or so? I'm sure there were many, but it's probably hard to think of them spontaneously.
There's several cases. For example, one boy with dystonia. I operated on him when he was 9 years old, I think, or no, 7 years old. And for 2 years, he was in a wheelchair. He couldn't walk anymore. And then I operated on him, and the effect was spectacular, as you know, in this one case. And then he gave me a plate, which he had painted on it. He had painted a heart. And then in German, vielen Dank, dass ich wieder laufen kann. So thank you very much that I can run again. So I have had in my career several gifts from patients, but this is worth gold to me. Yeah.
So it's amazing. Love it. Yeah. The opposite of that is, failed things or just waste of your time, or, you invested in something and then you found out it didn't work, or it's always healthy to talk about these things as well. I think if not, people only hear the success stories. Do you have examples of failures?
Yeah, as a waste of time, I never had the feeling this was a waste of time, never. But failures or complications, oh yes. I remember in Maastricht, I implanted electrodes for SEG. And then at left of the temporal bone, I implant the screw in the skull so that the electrode could be passed through it. But I continued screwing, and I'm not very proud of it, but it ended up just before the brainstem. Mm.
Okay.
The patient had any symptom related to that. And then, of course, I found it very, very important to discuss all your complications openly. So then in the morning session, the images were shown with all the colleagues. I said, oh my goodness, how is this possible? And then we discussed, of course, shall we leave it in place or remove it? We decided to just let it in place because the patient had no
symptoms. Yeah.
But every time I think that, I said, oh my goodness, how was that possible? Yeah.
And I'm sure if they are honest, every surgeon will have few
Absolutely.
Of these cases, right? So that is probably
Absolutely.
One of the, I think I remember in the first semester in medicine, the surgeons gave these talks were called bonbon talks. We were not clinical yet, but it was to inspire and so on. It was I think it was a lot of fun for the professors as well. And they said something like that. One surgeon said, it was a general surgeon, visceral surgeon, said something like, you know, in surgery you have big successes, but sometimes also, you could cut a nerve very easily, or, you have these very easy failures as well. So, and probably in internal medicine, it's not like that, where you have more subtle, of course you can also have, great successes and so on, but it's less direct, right? Probably in your profession, it is very direct of tied in.
Yeah, I say sometimes neurosurgery is a great big medal with two sides, very, very nice sides, but also if you have a failure, it could feel very, very bad.
Makes sense. So any advice for young researchers or clinical, you know, medicine MDs entering neuroscience, neurosurgery in academia, medicine?
Shoot for the moon. Even if you miss it, you will land among the stars.
Love it. Any advice for women in the field?
Follow your dreams also for them. I never had bad experiences being a woman, on the contrary.
Great. That's good. Because I think we need more women, female leaders. So I always had, you know, I often had the privilege of having female bosses, and it was great, actually. So I think there's certainly need for female also surgeons coming in. Yeah.
Or role models, perhaps.
Role models as well. Exactly. So what do you think does the future of the field look like? So, you know, where will we stand in 10 years with DBS, or in 5 years or so?
I think the field will have exploded due to other indications, like, for example, Alzheimer dementia. I think, and I hope, or I hope and I think. What I'm a little bit worried about is the possibilities of enhancement.
Hmm.
At the INS in Barcelona, I heard a talk by Itzhak Fried, who showed that in rats, a memory, a specific memory, could be instilled. Mm-hmm. That's scary, isn't it? So during sleep, so when the rat woke up, he thought that they really had experienced this situation, although it was not true.
Mm.
And I can imagine that if we succeed in having good effects in Alzheimer patients, that other people who have a lot of money might be interested in having the surgery to have their memory improved or enhanced.
Mm.
And I'm fully, of course, fully against that. And I'm a little bit worried about that evolution.
Mm. I just had one episode in this podcast with Mike Oken and Kelly Foote, and Kelly Foote talked about that as well. And I think what he said is that, you know, not only it will happen probably because, you know, we have plastic surgery as well, right? It started as a therapeutic field, but it has become quite big in, you know, enhancing your body. So sooner or later, there will be, as you say, people with a lot of money that could do it on oil platforms or whatever, right? Mm. If they really wanted to, they can probably just do it. I worry about that a bit as well. I mean, what I think, you know, as a remedy to that, you know, I always think we, with DBS, we can fix what is broken, even in, you know, in Alzheimer's. I think of the, personally, as how DBS for Alzheimer's will work is that there must be some sort of noise in the network, and we can tune down that noise, right? So something is, very simple terms, something is broken, there's a noise oscillation, a bit like the beta power in Parkinson's that we understand better, and we can tune that down, and then maybe the network can function again. That's how I see it, where in very brief and simple terms. That would mean that, you know, we cannot automatically enhance memory if we wanted to. But I don't know, do you have thoughts on that? Like, do we fix what's broken with DBS, or are we even able to, especially with lesioning, it's more clear, you know, can we lesion somewhere to enhance brain function?
Mm-hmm. Or even DBS, because the very first case of Lozano has shown that. So in 2008, he performed, or he planned to do, hypothalamic DBS in a patient with obesity. And during test simulation, the patient started to recall flashbacks. So he the patient had no memory deficits. And then afterwards, did extensive neuropsychological tests, and his memory was improved with his hypothalamic, which was then a phoenix stimulation. So okay. I do think enhancement of normal functions is
possible.
It's possible with DBS, yes. Mm.
And I mean, but the way that will work must be that, you know, then the memory network gets more time to compute, right? Or more. I sometimes think that, you know, these big networks, like your default mode network, they intrinsically suppress the other big networks, because if not, you have chaos in the brain, right? So if default mode network is active, past positive, you know, network goes down. So that means if we can shift the balance, you know, towards, let's say, more the memory network, maybe what we do is we buy the network more time, but we would suppress, or like have the other networks have less time, right? So do you think there will then be a balance? You know, we enhance memory, but there's some other function that we might not be aware of that we suppress in the same time? Or do you think it's really, you know?
I don't think that.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't think that. What you said about one network becomes more active and the other one goes down, it's what the default network has. So, the default network is active in our brains, and when we actively think, then it goes down a little bit. But the energy consumption when we actively think is such a very small part of the activity of the activity in rest that I think it would be possible to increase the performance of the default network or memory function, which is in a way related, not on the cost of other functions, I think.
Yeah, we both think so. It's super interesting. I'm
absolutely
sure we will find. I hope we will find out more about that going forward. So, last question. We spoke about future of the field. Are there missed opportunities? So things we should be doing at the moment as a field in neuromodulation that we are not doing enough, or should be doing more?
Yeah, I think we should have us more heard. We as neurosurgeons, and then I think specifically of the problems with the CE marks and so on. Actually, we're very well. We so easily accept the actual situation. So that's where there is a missed chance, I think. And I hope that's what this paper, something will change, that we unite forces.
Yeah,
for the benefit of the patient.
Yeah, I love that. So the idea to speak up more, or to essentially become more political, right? Because you
absolutely
care about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Vera, thank you so much. Do you have another, you know, something I did not cover that you wanted to talk about, or any other thought?
No, I really enjoyed this interview very much. Thank you, Annie.